I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. We devote both hours of today's show to what the country might look like in the not-too-distant future. In the second hour, we meet Paul Taylor, who studies the nation's demographics for the Pew Research Center. He's taken a long and deep look at what happens up ahead when today's millennials replace the baby boomers who raised them. Paul Taylor joins us for the second hour of our look at the next America. Up front, Ben Ross is our guest, a longtime advocate for more public transportation in Maryland. Ben Ross has a lot to say about how and where Americans will live in the coming decades. Our look at the future begins after the news about the present from NPR. And welcome to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks with you every Monday through Friday right here on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick in Hagerstown, WYPO out of Ocean City on the eastern shore of Maryland, streaming live online through WYPR.org. We thank you again for making Midday part of your day. We devote both hours of today's show to what the country might look like in the not-too-distant future. In the second hour, we'll hear from Paul Taylor, who studies the nation's demographics for the Pew Research Center. He's taken a long and deep look at what is likely to happen economically, socially, and politically as today's millennials replace the baby boomers who raised them. Paul Taylor joins us for the second hour of our look at The Next America, which is the title of his book. Here in the first hour, our guest is Benjamin Ross, a longtime advocate for more public transportation in Maryland, who's written a book about how we live, where we live, and what he sees in the coming years. The book is called Dead End, Suburban Sprawl, and the Rebirth of American Urbanism. In it, Ben Ross details how suburban and exurban sprawl began and flourished in the 20th century. But young Americans are no longer smitten with this idea of finely manicured lawns and kid-friendly cul-de-sacs and long commutes in their cars and SUVs. Ben Ross offers some insight into how a larger part of American society might transition away from the suburban ideal and how smart growth might revitalize urban centers and reduce our carbon footprints. Ben Ross is the former president of the Action Committee for Transit and a vocal proponent of the Washington, D.C. area Purple Line transit expansion. His book comes out next month from Oxford University Press. He joins us now to discuss suburbia and what the future might look like here. It's nice to have you with us, Ben. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be here.
I read the subtitle of the book about the latter part of it, The Rebirth of American Urbanism, and just, you know, it's tempting to ask you, is this wishful thinking or is this something you see happening that's really happening?
Oh, no, it's really happening. If you look at house prices, you can see the demand is to live downtown. After the bust, the prices downtown really didn't go down that much. The further out you get, the more the prices went down and the less they've come back.
So there's demand.
There's absolutely demand.
And where are we seeing it? Who's moving back to cities? I mean, we've talked about it a little bit here in terms of Baltimore. We're seeing some population growth after decades of population decline, many decades of population decline. We've talked about it a little bit here. Who do you see moving back to cities?
I think it's mostly people that are younger, in their 20s and 30s. There are older people, but it's very much a generational thing, in my observation.
It's the millennials that we'll be talking about during this show?
Yes.
And why? What's driving it? What are the obvious things and the maybe not so apparent things?
Well, I mean, part of it is just the traffic, of course, and the terrible commutes if you live too far out. But I think there's also a cultural change, a change of values. There was for 100 years the idea that being a suburbanite with a house with a front lawn and driving everywhere was superior to everything else. But we got to the point where everybody had a front lawn, everybody drove, and people growing up, it was just no longer a sign of anything, and they didn't like the commute.
So it was a matter of status, and you contend in your book that it sort of peaked, the suburban status idea.
Oh, I think it's definitely peaked. It's a lot of people still defend it, but it has peaked, and younger people look at things differently.
You come at this from the transit side of things, so I think it'd be interesting here to just stop for a minute and talk about your own experience and your own thinking about this. You grew up on Long Island. You ended up here in the Washington, D.C. area and very much involved in getting the Purple Line going. Why was that so important to you? Why did you step into advocacy for that reason?
Well, I was living at one end of it when it was first proposed, or about a mile past. I wrote a letter to the editor of the local paper saying, why don't you extend it a couple miles more past my house?
And where was that, Bethesda?
In Bethesda, yeah. I wanted to go up to Montgomery Mall. And somebody called me up and said, you ought to be a member of our organization.
Because that's what we want, too.
Yeah.
What do we get out of the Purple Line? We talk in the Baltimore area a lot about the proposed Red Line. Well, it's more than proposed Red Line. But what do you see as the advantages that come of the Purple Line? And describe for our listeners a bit where it runs.
Yeah, it runs, starts in the middle of downtown Bethesda, runs through the middle of Silver Spring. Then it goes through Langley Park, which is the largest Hispanic center in the state of Maryland, and also has one of the busiest bus stops outside downtown Baltimore in the state. Then it goes right through the middle of the Maryland campus in College Park, and it winds up in New Carrollton at the Amtrak station.
And you like it because it connects all these mini communities, not mini anymore. They're suburban. This is completely suburban, what you just described.
That's right. It's really a unique project in the country in being completely suburban as a very heavily used rail line.
Okay, so you have a series of what we'll call them city centers, Silver Spring, Bethesda, you mentioned Langley Center. So it's not just about getting people to downtown D.C.
That's right. It will help people get to the metro into downtown D.C., but the main purpose is for trips within the suburbs. It's parallel to the Washington Beltway, which is horrendously congested, and it gives people an alternative and lets us keep building up downtown Bethesda and Silver Spring, which are very economically strong, and also lets us build up more jobs in Prince George's County, which needs them badly.
So a vital part of any rebirth of urbanism is transportation.
Oh, absolutely. It's totally linked in.
Well, how did we get here, Ben? I want to spend a little time on the history. It's always interesting to me to talk about the history of suburban America and how we got here. And you lay it out really beautifully in your book here. You even go back to the late 19th century for the roots of this and mention some things that happened here in the Baltimore area, in Baltimore City, along the way. So why don't you go back with us a little bit? How did all this happen? The cities used to be full of people working in factories and they were very busy, crowded places.
Well, that's right. And it started really spreading with streetcars and railroads. Roland Park was one of the first upscale suburbs. It pioneered the system of the homeowner association that required approval of any of your architectural changes. Mm-hmm. And it worked really well there because they hired one of the country's greatest architects as their reviewer.
What was so special about Roland Park?
It was the first place that they had the requirement of approving your architecture.
Okay, but what else? What else made it part of this the suburban growth? Because you presented it as a sort of an ideal planned community.
Well, that's right. It was designed by great architects. It was close enough to the city. It had the railroad connection. It had a little shopping district in the center. And it was really a very attractive place to live and work, and you could work in the city.
Because it was well planned.
Oh, very well planned.
Okay. So what happened, because you grew up in Long Island, I guess you're very familiar with what happened in the 1950s and 60s. I mean, we're all familiar with that. But what accelerated all that growth in the suburbs? Was it white flight from the cities? Was it race? Was it people wanted just to be out in the fresh air? They thought living in the suburbs presented an ideal?
Well, I think there were several reasons that went together. I think people fundamentally thought that these initial planned communities like Roland Park that were quite expensive were very attractive. People liked them, and people further down the ladder wanted to imitate them. And so you got the Levittowns, which were, after the Second World War, very attractive, much smaller lots. And they, instead of having this shopping center around the railroad station, they kind of ignored that, and you wound up with strip malls along the highway. And it moved down the socioeconomic ladder, so it was done more cheaply. And then on top of that, sometimes something that works in small doses doesn't scale. And I think suburbia was an example of that.
What do you mean? Elaborate on that, please.
When you have some people living in the suburbs in these towns and riding into downtown, it works well. If everything starts moving out of the city, the jobs move out of the city, everyone gets into the car. It was very nice to drive places when the road was empty. The roads crowd up, and it doesn't work the way it used to.
And the federal government had a role in making all this happen that's worth describing. We know, for instance, about the highway system that was put in place here that really accelerated the growth of the suburbs. But you also make the point about long-term mortgages. This is interesting to me because that's something I just assumed was around forever, but wasn't around forever.
No, the long-term mortgage, the 30-year mortgage, was invented by the New Deal. Before that, you basically the only thing you could get was a balloon mortgage, and so they had that really helped people move into the suburbs because especially after the Second World War, people had some savings but not a lot. They had a job with good pay. But they couldn't put 50% down. And so the invention of the 30-year mortgage with 10, 20% down made an enormous difference to the growth of the suburbs.
And then there's the automobile, too. The automobile industry is sort of working hand-in-hand with all of this, the federal government building highways.
Well, that's right, the federal government building highways. And it wasn't just the building of the big highways. It was also the way they changed the design of the local streets to favor the movement of the cars and push the pedestrians off to the side, made the cities less pleasant. It's sort of, if you go to a place out in the suburbs, very often you'll find that even though your lunch place is across the road, you have to drive to get there. Mm-hmm. And and that really discourages people from taking the bus to work, even if they could. It all adds up.
It's interesting to think of people who grew up in those areas. Of course, you grew up in a suburban area, too, up in Long Island, right?
That's right.
But if you grow up in the last, 20 years or so in an area like that, it's familiar to you. It's comfortable. It's what you know. It's where you went to high school. You drove everywhere, right? You went to the mall. You went to maybe a strip shopping center someplace to go to a restaurant or something like that. So that's familiar to you. You get in your car, you go someplace. So what is it, besides the price of gasoline, which is kind of the obvious thing, right? What is it about that that's turning this, we'll go back to the younger generation in the future, what it looks like, what your vision of it is anyway, to say, wait a minute, this isn't making sense. Is it $3.79 a gallon for gasoline, or is it something more than that?
Oh, I think it's definitely cultural. If you look at the numbers, you'll see that while people riding transit's gone up, carpooling keeps going down. So it's not the price of gasoline that's doing it. People would rather live in the city where they can walk around. They don't have to get in the car for every place they want to go, meet their friends in the street, drop in someplace, walk home from a bar is very pleasant. It's just a style of life that attracts people.
So you think, but it's younger people. So you think it's the millennials looking at this and saying, "Dad, Mom, you did a good job, but I don't really want to live here anymore. I don't want to live like this. I don't want to have to get in the car all the time."
That seems to be what it is. I'm kind of mystified because about my own generation, because I'm very much a baby boomer. Mm-hmm. Because when I was growing up, we grew up in the suburbs, but all we wanted to do on the weekend in high school was go into the city. And our generation has rebuilt some downtown neighborhoods, but on the whole, it's been very wedded to the suburbs.
Ben Ross is our guest in this hour of midday. Dead End is the name of his book, Suburban Sprawl and the Rebirth of American Urbanism. We'll continue our conversation with Ben in just a minute. If you'd like to join our conversation, please give us a ring at midday, 410-662-8780. Our midday email address, you can write a question for Ben Ross or comment, midday@wypr.org. And welcome back to Midday, our look at the future, what the future might look like. If you follow Ben Ross's vision, it's cities filling up again, cities becoming more populated, although probably a slow trend. But you see maybe in the next 10 years, 20 years, a city like Baltimore, continuing to gain population. You think that's a possibility here?
Oh, I think absolutely. I think Baltimore has some great assets that it can take advantage of.
Please list them for us. What do you see as a bit of an outsider from Bethesda?
I think the fact that you've got the street layout of small blocks, lots of neighborhoods around downtown that have small blocks, old houses, row houses, I think it's a tremendous asset. I was last week in Jacksonville, Florida, where they're working to revive their downtown. And their problem is they don't have that kind of neighborhood around the downtown. So the downtown is kind of isolated.
So it's just a downtown. It's a place where you go to work. There's not really houses, neighborhoods adjoining it.
That's right. That's right. And it's
I've never been to Jacksonville. So it's sort of a big suburban city, isn't it?
It's a big suburban city with a whole bunch of skyscrapers downtown.
Right. And so what are they thinking there? What do they need? They don't have much public transit or what's
going
on? They
have almost no public transit.
Mm-hmm.
They have they've done quite a bit to revive their downtown, and people are thirsty for it. They had a downtown festival a couple of weeks ago on the weekend. They had 500,000 people, or not 500,000, but 50,000 people thronging downtown. They have this rail people mover that's usually empty because it doesn't go much of anywhere, and it was overcrowded. People are thirsting for it.
So what do they think? If you build it, they will come. If you have a more interesting downtown with, entertainment, culture, more restaurants or something. But people don't want to have to just drive to it each time, right? Is it the idea here the next generation is going to want to live nearby, walk to it, take a bike?
That's right. That's right. Or take the train to it.
What has happened in Portland, Oregon, another city that we talk about a lot when it comes to smart planning, when we talked about smart growth in particular, what do you see there?
Well, they're really uniquely successful, or almost uniquely successful in the country. And they've done two things. One is that they built a light rail network when they didn't have any rail transit. And the other is that the state has a growth boundary law. And as a result of that, to prevent sprawl, they've really made it easier to build within the city. It's much easier than in most places to turn a single family house into a duplex. You can build small apartment buildings without too much trouble.
This is called infill, right?
That's right.
Yeah. I used to think about Baltimore here. I remember commenting once in my column about how one day in the future, someone will look back to Baltimore at this period of time that we've been in through the 70s, 80s, 90s, into the new century, and they'll see all this vacancy, all these abandoned areas that just was begging for infill, while the suburbs, the old farms and everything, 30, 40 miles away from Baltimore, were being filled in with new housing. Wonder, you know, what was going to bring that back? Of course, there's all kinds of social factors going on there, but you have these big holes that need to be filled in. You could have potentially 800,000, 900,000 people in a city like Baltimore.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's, the more people that move in, the more attractive it'll be, and the more it will attract more people.
Ben Ross is our guest. His book is Dead End, Suburban Sprawl and the Rebirth of American Urbanism. Is a picture of a cul-de-sac on the jacket of the book. When you say dead end, what do you mean? Do you mean that what we said before earlier, that the suburban life has kind of peaked and that's about it for now, and we're gonna see a trend the other way? Is that what you mean?
That is what I mean. I think that the system of building more suburbs further out while you let the ones closer in decay has just become unsupportable.
Let's go to the phone lines and welcome our listeners to join this conversation with Ben Ross in this first hour of Midday Today. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address for questions or comments that way, midday@wypr.org. Here's Jeff in Baltimore. We'll start with him. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I just wanted to make a comment that I appreciate your guest and the book that he's written. I think part of what has drawn people back to the city is a sense of community. Give you a real brief history. My parents and grandparents grew up in and lived in downtown Philly. And then I had the opportunity to move to the Midwest, and we lived in an urban area in Grand Rapids, Michigan for 18 years. And then about 6 years ago, we moved back to the Baltimore region and live now in Severna Park, which is a suburban area between Baltimore and Annapolis. And the 18 years that we lived in the urban area in the Midwest, we were able to be involved in a community. I worked and we went to church and we shopped in stores that were all fairly close to each other. And houses were built close to the street, and you sat out on your front porch and steps at night, and you shoveled the sidewalks together. And there was this sense of community. People knew houses were fairly close together. And you got to know your neighbors, and you watched and you supported one another, and there's conversation, you did things together. But in the suburbs, you just don't have that, especially in such a stark contrast when we moved into Severna Park, which is a fairly upper-class neighborhood, and just did not have that sense of community. People had driveways or garages they pulled in, parked, and went inside the house, and there wasn't much activity or connection with your neighbors at all, if any.
Yeah.
That, I think, is a fairly large draw, or could be a large draw, to the idea of the millennials wanting to have that sense of community and, you know, the whole social media thing, but in real life, that you don't get in the suburban setting, in which most of them grew up in, and had a lack of that sense of neighboring.
Jeff, thank you for that comment. Let's hear from Ben on that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, one of the things that we haven't really succeeded in doing in this return to the city is building those old city neighborhood type places. You know, we build these high-rise areas, but we very bad at building those neighborhoods where you got the one, two, three family houses, little apartment buildings all packed together. And that's where you really get to know your neighbors. And we have to get better at doing that. And that's one of the advantages Baltimore has, that it has a lot of those places.
I was interested and amused 20 years ago, 15 years ago, when some suburban malls started building main streets or avenues with restaurants, movie theater, that primarily was it, and some boutique shops, maybe a bookstore or something. And it looked like a main street, but you had to drive there, right? You couldn't easily access it from nearby housing.
Yeah. Yeah, the real litmus test of those places is look where the bus stop is. If the bus stop goes down the main street and has bus stops on the main street, then you got a real main street.
Mm-hmm.
Usually in those things, you'll find the bus stop on the backside of the parking garage.
Vishan Chakrabarti, who is, I believe, an architect in New York, wrote a book last year on a similar subject, A Country of Cities, I think is the title of it, Ben. He points out something else about the millennial interest in living in the city. People think living in cities is expensive. In Baltimore, in terms of property taxes that you pay, yeah, it's more expensive. You can get a better deal usually going in on a house in the city than you can in the suburbs. So for some people, it's a wash one way or the other, but you do pay higher taxes. However, when we're talking about the millennials, this next generation you see coming into cities and fostering its rebirth, he says the economic challenges of starting a life in the suburbs have grown. Mortgages and car loans are harder to get for millennials, especially as they deal with onerous college debt. Though rents are increasing, it's easier to rent an apartment in the city and take a bus or subway to work. Millennials are also delaying the decision to have kids, which makes a compact urban living easier.
Yeah, well, I can speak to that personally because I went through a relatively tough economic time at the time I moved into downtown Bethesda, and I got rid of my car as an experiment, and the money that I saved was enormous. And people would ask me, well, isn't it inconvenient to live without a car. And my response was, it's a lot more fun to spend your money on a Bethesda restaurant than driving on the Beltway.
Mm-hmm. So how did you do in terms of that? How did you adjust to life without a car? Public transportation, for instance?
Bethesda has a metro station.
Yeah. It's pretty good there.
Yeah, it's pretty good there. And the key is when you need to take a $20 taxi ride to get someplace, don't think, is this really worth a $20 taxi ride? Think, do I want to spend $20 on a taxi ride or $15,000 on a car?
All right. Let's go to another caller. Kimberly on York Road somewhere giving us a ring. Hi, Kimberly.
Hey, gentlemen. Dan, I want to say thank you so much for your program. I listen to you every day going into school at Towson.
Excellent. Thank you.
I think you bring some really great information to the public, and I'm thankful for that.
Thank you, Kimberly.
My request is if your guest would speak to the issue of racism, institutionalized racism, that plays a critical role in the development of suburbia and its exclusion of non-white people, and they're being relegated basically to the city to pick up the pieces.
Well, it definitely plays a role, but my view is that it plays a very important role, but it was kind of an accelerator and not the thing that started off. In fact, when I was researching the book, I found the most astonishing story about the birth of suburbia. The first restrictive covenants that were about the size of the house and the setbacks and so on were actually written by the abolitionists. Harriet Beecher Stowe's nephew, Wendell Phillips' son, mm-hmm. were people in the first community suburb that had a homeowners association and restrictive covenants. And of course, they had nothing at all about race. They only added race to the restrictive covenants in the 1890s.
Mm-hmm. So at first it was a class thing, social status thing.
Originally it was actually a dissident thing. It was almost a commune that evolved into this first suburb.
That's interesting. Yeah.
It was all the leftists. And then by the 1880s and 1890s, it became a class thing. And then as part of the end of Reconstruction and the increasing segregation in the country, they added race. And then by the 1920s, race really became a driving
factor. And in some places, ethnicity as well.
Yes.
Right. Now, if you move things up to the 1950s, the Brown versus Board of Education decision by the Supreme Court, 1954, that would be 60 years ago, I believe, next month in May. And I was struck once by looking at a chart of Baltimore's population, and it was uncanny to me how the population of the city descended almost off a cliff starting around 1954, 1955, the desegregation of the public schools. I mean, this definitely was an ingredient, but you're saying already suburban life had already been established. Roads were being built there. There was status in it. So racism or race, concerns about race, accelerated all that.
Right. They accelerated it, made it much more severe and harder to stop.
Let's go to another phone call. Ed in Mount Vernon, you're up next on Midday. Hello.
Hello, Dan and Ben. I was wondering, Ben, if you could comment on the street patterns of the cul-de-sac development on traffic and therefore on commuting times and on frustration. Because when you look at the city, you see a grid pattern with all the streets going through. So there are many pathways for people to take to get where they're going if one gets blocked up. But out in the suburbs, a bunch of cul-de-sacs are on a circle. The circle is connected to one road. That one road connects to one main road in the development that then goes out to a two-lane blacktop.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it's very hard to fix because if you try to just open up one cul-de-sac, all the traffic will go there. And so people don't want their cul-de-sac opened up first.
These things developed, though, because people felt safe in them? Because why? Why? That particular style of suburban development, what led to that?
It was partly that people felt safe there, but it was also kind of an ideological thing, rejection of grid streets. Actually, in the 1930s and 40s, the Federal Housing Authority Administration, the FHA, said that grid streets by themselves were a sign of blight. And it was like an ideological effort to get rid of grid streets.
Hmm. Here's a comment from Jennifer, which speaks to the idea of city living, city life, urban life with small children. She says, I grew up in the inner city. I could not go outside and play unless I had parental supervision. I would have killed to be raised in the suburbs. I longed for a yard to play in and safe neighbors and children with whom to play. I was a virtual prisoner until I was old enough to take care of myself on the street. City living is great for people without small children. Now, we hear this, too, in Baltimore a lot. People would say, you know, it's great being a young couple, maybe, or just single, and then married, newlyweds, and being a double income, no kids for a while. City life is great. And then when you get around to having children, you got to think about a school to put them in. And until the schools have, improve, we don't trust the public schools. It costs us more money to put a child in a private school in Baltimore City or a parochial school. And then, so we'll just go to the suburbs. We'll just go to Baltimore County or Harford County or Howard County and have a great school system and lower property tax. It still looks very appealing to lots of people at that stage of life.
Well, yes, but what's happened in the suburbs, and it's something that I really dislike, is that children in the suburbs aren't allowed to go out by themselves either, even when there's no danger at all. People have an exaggerated idea of the danger. And really, by the time that they're in junior high school, and certainly high school, city kids are much more independent and need much less supervision. So I think that cuts both ways. In some cities, you're now seeing a flood of parents with kids in the suburbs. There was a very funny article in the city. A very funny article in Brooklyn where the a bar in Brooklyn where the 30-something guys that and 20-something singles that hung out there were up in arms about all the strollers coming in.
We're going to take another break here, and we'll come back and talk some more with Benjamin Ross, longtime activist in Maryland for public transportation, especially the Purple Line down in the D.C. area. He's now written a book called Dead End, Suburban Sprawl and the Rebirth of American Urbanism, taking a look here at the future of how we're going to live and where we're going to live. 410-662-8780 is our phone number for midday if you'd like to join our conversation. Toll-free long distance, good from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309. And our email address, questions, comments, welcome by email, midday@wypr.org. Well, here's an email, Ben, from Elaine, who's sort of echoing what I had said to you a moment ago about children and what the earlier email said about raising kids in the city. And I said, you know, why suburban life still looks very appealing to people at that stage of life, having young children. I'm going to stand up for the American suburb as the best option, says Elaine, perhaps in the world for families raising kids, at least those families who don't have unlimited resources for private schooling, household help, family-sized apartments, etc. The suburbs offer good public schools, relatively affordable housing, open space, public safety, and athletic opportunity for our kids. While walking to bars was at some point in our lives a priority, we are beyond that, and the city, just about any city, doesn't offer what families need.
Well, I think that the city does offer that. Cities are full of neighborhoods. You know, Baltimore is certainly not just downtown. The quality of the schools, obviously very important. But there's nothing intrinsic that schools and cities have to be bad. And to some extent, the quality of the schools follows the socioeconomic trends. And I wouldn't be surprised in 5 or 10 years to see the schools in cities like D.C., New York, San Francisco being much better than some of their suburbs. Suburbs have a lot of tax problems.
Think about this for a minute. If this happens, if this really happens, say, let's just talk about Baltimore. Say the schools really do improve, and we say we have more millennials moving into the city and caring about the city, becoming active citizens, engaged in what happens in the city. Say there's pressure to bring the property tax down to make it more affordable for more people. Say those things happen. Say they get the crime under control and stops becoming a city with a reputation for violent crime. And you have this sort of critical mass of younger people moving in. The city becomes safer, maybe more cleaner looking. I don't know. More populated, more people. If all that happens, what happens to the suburbs? I mean, the people would be very concerned about that house they owned, and they own in Elkridge or Ellicott City or out in Harford County or wherever it is that they invested a lot of money in once upon a time. The demand, if the demand shifts for housing, for residents in the city, that threatens what's out there, what we've built, spent so much time building.
Well, that's a real issue. I mean, I think it's very important that we build up our suburban centers in the Baltimore area, places like Towson, Owings Mills, that can be anchors for the suburbs. People will certainly always want to live. I mean, anyone would like a big house on a half-acre lot that's a 5-minute walk to the MARC station.
So you don't think that's going to go away? You're not saying that's going away?
No, not at all.
Do we have the population to sustain that, though? Are we going to have the population growth to sustain all of this?
Well, that we'll have to see. I mean, that's...
There was a time when people abandoned housing in the city and went to the suburbs. Yeah. Now, I mean, could the reverse be happening, I guess? I heard people say during the housing bust that, you know, those McMansions out there, those suburban developments are tomorrow's ghetto.
It could happen. It could happen. And it's very important that we develop the suburbs to keep them going.
Let's take another call. This one's from Towson Ben just mentioned, Towson. Here's Michael. Thanks for joining
us. Yes, I have a question regarding municipal policy towards stores and storefronts, that kind of thing. And the reason I ask is that in Towson, on York Road, just south of the traffic circle, one side of the road is tiny little stores that have always had owners, and the other side was this giant development that failed horribly. Yeah. They're building another development. They put up a movie theater, and they're going to have sort of big chain restaurants. It would strike me that if you do want to have communities, and I also want to mention I lived in Paris, so I've seen these little stores. If you want to have communities that take advantage of, actual city life, you have to have stores small enough that, say, a single individual rather than a corporation can afford. Would you be able to discuss, like, frontage and square footage for stores in regards to your interest in cities? I'll take my question.
Michael, thank you for that question. And while you're on it, Ben, you might want to talk about White Flint, Arlington, places that you mentioned in your book.
Right. I think the question that he raises is a real one. It's a very tough issue because right now we have these approval processes that are so complicated. It's very easy to lay out a bunch of single-family houses, get your building permits, build them. But we've made the approval processes for city-type buildings much more difficult, and the small landowner can't afford them. So I think that simplifying the zoning rules and putting suburban type and city type building on an equal footing is very important, and especially for bringing back that small store.
Mm-hmm.
Tyson's Corner is an area
of... Oh, that's another one I wanted to talk about.
Tyson's Corner in White Flint in the Washington suburbs, White Flint's in Montgomery County, are areas where they're trying to turn these areas of strip malls and office towers surrounded by parking lots into a walkable downtown. I think White Flint is much more promising in my point of view. But what they're doing there is really expensive. And it will be high-end stuff there because it's going to cost them well north of $100 million to fill in all the missing streets in the middle of where the parking lots are now.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've really got to do is figure out how to do that less expensively.
Yeah.
And that's where Baltimore has a big advantage because you've got all kinds of areas where that kind of infrastructure is already there.
The infrastructure is there, and it would be fairly easy, relatively easy, to redevelop in that way.
That's right. And you can do it piece by piece.
Yeah.
You don't have to do it all at once.
Here's Betsy in Baltimore, our next caller on Midday. Hello, Betsy.
Hi. I just wanted to respond to the email that you read about suburbs are better. And I live in the city, and I live in a community called Remington. And I'm very safe in this community. The kids run around in my neighborhood and play on the playground up the street from me. And it's a community. My neighbors watch my dogs when I go away. I watch theirs. You know, we have a lot of things going on in the community, in the neighborhood, and we know each other. When I walk the dog, people say hi to me. I have lived in small towns in upstate New York, and I've lived in the suburbs, and, you know, I really love living in the city.
What about schools, Betsy?
I actually don't have any children, so I don't know about schools, but we do have Margaret Brent up the street, which Remington apparently has one of the highest concentrations of children in the city, which I didn't know about until I went to a neighborhood association meeting. And most of them go to Margaret Brent or, what's the other, there's another one up the street, and I can't remember what that one is.
Okay. So you're pointing out to us these aren't your own children, but there are children in Remington who are live there and manage to live there and go to school.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they go to the playground. I see them in the playground up the street from me. And weather like this, they're all over the place. It's great.
Thank you very much. I mean, I do hear the voice of that parent who wrote in earlier. I've heard this before. And for years, I heard this story of, loving the city, getting a row house, renting an apartment, enjoying life, Federal Hill, Canton, Fells Point, wherever it is, and then getting married, having children, and then, going the other way. Now, the trend is maybe as you get older and years pass, you raise your kids and then come back to the city. We do see older people, retirees, moving back into cities. That's another trend along with the millennials. Here's a comment from Steve in Baltimore. He says, this is hard to quantify, but I think there is a psychological and emotional benefit when working from home, which growing numbers are doing, in the city rather than in the suburbs if you are a telecommuter. In the city, you can walk to lunch or take your lunch to a nearby park or just step outside for a few minutes and you will probably encounter other people, ones you know or ones you don't. Even just the sounds of people in traffic make you feel less isolated when working from home in the city. You just feel less alone. Thank you very much for that comment. Our email address again, midday@wypr.org. Karen in Annapolis, you're on Midday with our guest, Ben Ross. Karen, you there? All right, we'll go to Brian. He's in Millersville with a question or comment. Hello, Brian.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Ben. I think you've touched on the school issue. That's what I originally called on, so I'll pass that up because you hit it pretty well. My second point that I wanted to raise with you guys would be the tax incentives for the redevelopment in the city. My understanding is that Baltimore still relies on the land, owner of the property is still taxed on the value of it. So a block of dilapidated row houses boarded up is taxed minimally because they're not worth anything on paper, whereas some cities have gone to reversal, making that tax rate higher to kind of incentivize a landlord, often an absentee landlord, to redevelop it or sell it to somebody who will redevelop it. And I think that's been done successfully in and around Washington, D.C., with some of the older housing. So, Ben, is that something that you've seen as a tax model?
Yeah. Well, my view of this is that you do much better to simplify the approval process and maybe have tax incentives for anyone that does certain things. And that way, the small landlord can take advantage of it. And you'll get more of those small stores that we were talking about a little while ago, rather than have these big targeted handouts to the big company.
Mm-hmm. Ben, what else do you see that's promising on the horizon? In terms of the communities looking to, you've done some speaking off this book. Even the book isn't even really published yet, so there is interest in it, right? In smaller cities, especially.
That's right. I was in Jacksonville.
You mentioned that one.
And there's interest in this all over. I'm going to Fresno next month.
Is it because we definitely see this trend of the millennial generation wanting to live in the city? Is that it?
That's absolutely.
So these cities want to be prepared. They're inviting this extra population.
Right. They really want to build up their downtowns.
Where does that leave the? We'll go back to that subject again. I'm curious about where that leaves the suburbs. You see them still as interconnected. If you have public transportation, the idea of still living in a suburban area and taking, as long as the public transportation's there, could remain appealing to people.
Well, I think it'll stay appealing to people. The danger is that they'll get into the kind of downward spiral that the cities got into in the 50s and 60s. If the house prices go down, they don't have enough tax revenue, so the schools tail off. You can see the beginnings of that process in some of the Virginia suburbs of D.C.
Mm-hmm.
So what you have to do is, I think, key is the public transportation to connect the suburbs to the city. Ideally, you want a rising tide that raises all the boats.
You know, Americans love their cars. But we have multiple cars, right, in families. You went for a while without a car. Right, so you're unusual there, but you think this trend will continue? Less interest in the long commute?
Oh, definitely. There's no question of
driving.
That.
You know, a new generation is sort of seeing the light here.
Oh yeah, much fewer people have licenses in their.
They're
late
waiting
teens.
Longer to get the licenses, right?
Yeah.
So it's all there. So this is actually what you wanted to see, right? Over the last 30 years that you've been thinking and talking about this.
Yeah, I mean it started happening on a much smaller scale in the 60s and 70s, but it has really picked up in the last 15 years.
And what about public will and public transportation? You know, I know we got the red line coming on, the purple line coming on. But there's so much more. Every time we do a show here on public transportation, there seems to be such a cry for it. And people calling from the suburbs and even the Eastern Shore is saying, what about a commuter bus for us?
Yeah, there's a tremendous demand, and that's where the government policies are way behind the public. You know, we're still putting so much money into highways, not as much as we used to, but we keep building new highways, sometimes when we don't even have the money to maintain the old ones. And we're woefully short on how much we're investing in transit.
Ben Ross has been our guest for a long time. He was president of Maryland's Action Committee for Transit. He served in that role for 15 years, and the Purple Line was your main goal, right, to get that established. So is that, by the way, as we speak today, is that still happening, or is it going forward? Does it face any litigation?
Well, it'll face some litigation, probably. But it's very close to going forward, along with the Red Line in Baltimore. I mean, there are two very important projects for the state, which the state right now is very committed to getting done.
Oxford University Press is the publisher of Benjamin Ross's book, Dead End, Suburban Sprawl and the Rebirth of American Urbanism. I want to share with our listeners the fact that Ben Ross will be speaking Thursday, April 24th, that's tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop, which is located at 6080 Falls Road, 6080 Falls Road in Baltimore. Ben will be there tomorrow night to speak, and we'll have copies of his book that's really in the process of being published, right? Okay. Thank you very much, Ben. Thanks for being with us.
This was a pleasure.
And that's the first hour of Midday Today, folks. We're going to continue our conversation about what the future of the country will look like. We have another whole hour of the show devoted to that subject, so I hope you'll stick around for that. We take a break now for lunch, brought to us by Breathe Bookstore Cafe, serving inspired vegetarian, vegan, gluten-free savories and sweets, and more. Open 7 days a week. They're at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. More information at breathebooks.com. Thank you to Breathe Books for providing lunch for our guests. A break here for the news, and then the second hour of Midday. I'll see you after the news.